It's West Coast.
Alrighty. Bet it is. Alright, ladies and gentlemen, it's Saturday, June 17th in Reading, Pennsylvania at Reverb. Fit for an autopsy, Moontooth. I have the Destroyer, Cranley Gardens, Let This Be Ours, are playing tonight, but the reason I'm here is because of the band in the direct support slot, a band from Brooklyn called Tombs, and I have the distinct pleasure of speaking to the mind, the heart, the soul of the band, Mike Hill. Welcome to Reading.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Alright, before I forget, I seem to recall hearing you guys played in Bethlehem. Maybe it was the Secret Art Space a few years ago.
That was quite a while ago, actually. That was more like 4 or 5 years ago.
Gotcha.
Maybe. Yeah, I remember that vaguely. I had to scan through the memory banks when you said playing at the Bethlehem, because yeah. I was like, wow, that's the distinct memory comes back to me, but I almost forgot about that show.
Well, you played enough to forget about it.
There's probably literally been 1,000 shows since then, so but I remember playing there, yeah.
Well, we're coming from the Allentown area, so it's right near there.
Okay,
so.
Sure.
Gotcha. All right, at the time we're speaking, The Grand Annihilation, in stores now, came out yesterday, June 16th. I was worried I would have to try to digest it all in 24 hours or less, but thankfully Metal Blade was kind enough to send it to me about 2 weeks in advance, so I gave it a little bit more of the service that it requires and deserves. So, yeah, thumbs up.
Thanks a lot, man. I appreciate it.
Now, you always try to push the envelope and change things up, but do you find your work tends to be a little bit reactionary to what has become before it? For example, early in your career, you weren't necessarily happy with the production, so you moved to Eric Rutan and got what you were hoping for with Savage Gold. And now with this, you're trying to do some more atmospheric stuff to offset, not offset, but like Savage Gold is a little more straightforward, hard-hitting, and now this incorporates that plus atmospheric, so...
Yeah, I mean, I think that early on when you're just starting out with the band, you have budget limitations on what you're able to do. And, you know, some of our earliest releases were self-recorded. And then, you know, we worked with a variety of different people, but we always had, like, pretty tight budgets. And, you know, as time goes on, you get, more resources to do these recordings. So Eric Rutan has always been somebody that I've looked up to and admired and, you know, really been a big fan of his work, both as a player and as an engineer. So it was great to finally get the opportunity to work with him. And I think that he's a big part of the sound and, you know, he brings that power, that sort of power to the music. And I don't think that we necessarily react to stuff, but I think that like when it comes to writing, I always try to add more elements and, you know, things that are influencing me at the time find their way into the music, so.
Was there one piece of his production work, Eric Rutan's production work, that you heard and were saying, we have to work with him?
Absolutely. It's all the Goat Whore records that he did. I'm a big fan of Goat Whore as well. Sure. And I'm like, man, these records sound great, you know, real powerful, you know, fast drums with, like, you know, with clarity, you know, which is very hard to do. And the guitar, everything about the recording sounded great. And, that seemed like a perfect fit for us, and so that's how we ended up, you know, working with Eric. Yeah.
Agreed. Now, did you hear the new Goat Whore? Because they went a different direction.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, it's great. You know, I love all their music. You know, and but I mean, they went a different direction, but they're still, like, you know, you can still tell it's them, man.
Sure.
It's still the same sort of, like, intense vibe that they have. You know, so.
Yeah. Well, the first time I heard it, I was like, whoa, this is more organic, raw. It's, you know, it didn't, and I looked at the credits and realized, oh, they made a change. All right.
So. Yeah, definitely. You know, it's, I mean, you know, every now and then you got to change things up, and that's, you know, everyone has their decisions, and,
sure.
You know, it's, I think it sounds, the album's great though, you know,
yeah,
so
totally.
you can't really complain.
Yeah. In a press release for the album, you were quoted as saying, and I'm paraphrasing here, of course, that when you were younger, you were writing more personal lyrics, and as you've gotten older, you've been writing broader themes that are a little more widely relatable. Does this also reflect your perspective on life?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, when you're a young kid, you kind of have, like, more of, like, a very claustrophobic perspective on the world, and, you know, and maybe... you know, your life is so intense when you're a young man.
Yeah.
And as you get older, you start looking at the bigger picture and you start seeing that there's more to life than just, like, the immediate stuff that's affecting you. And you broaden your mind. And I think that's kind of like that change in my life perspective probably is reflected in the artistic perspective of the music, too.
Sure.
So.
All right. You've said you're always writing ideas, lyrics, riffs, whether at home or on the road. In one of the interviews that I've came across. Do you find yourself operating differently? Like when you're at home, do you get up at a certain time and then devote time to write? Or when you're on the road, do you just, when you're at the hotel at night, try to write?
Actually, I write a lot of ideas when we're sound checking, like on at least on tour, or in those like times before the set when we're warming up, like a lot of riff ideas pop into my head around that time. And then at home, it's definitely more of like, on a weekly basis, I like look at my schedule and I'm like, okay, Tuesday morning, I'm going to start working on ideas between these hours. And, you know, it's hard to make it a daily practice, but it's something I look at the week and I'm like, okay, I want to spend about 5 or 6 hours this week working on music, being in demos or riff ideas or outside of practice, that is. So, I try to schedule it in just like everything else in the day.
The album is notable for being your full-length debut for the mighty Metal Blade Records. Now, I'm not sure if hockey is your bag, but was Brian Slagle's courtship of the band involving taking you to any LA Kings games?
I don't know anything about hockey, man. I'm actually not even a sports fan, to be honest. So, you know, it's just, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, I guess they liked the band and they wanted to work with us. You know, that's kind of how it goes.
Well, MMA is a sport, and we're going to get to that. All right. Well, speaking of working again with Eric Rutan, do you find the consistency in the studio that you had, did that alleviate some of the stress of recording?
Absolutely. I mean, Eric Rutan is definitely the captain of the ship when you go into the studio. And I like that basically you just do what he tells you to do and you can trust that the record's going to come out well and just listen to him and what he has to say and his direction. And you can trust him that his ears are going to hear any kind of mistakes or inconsistencies or performance flaws or any of that sort of stuff. And that's something that I really was looking for. And I've known that Eric was a guy who can deliver that sort of stuff to a session. And it's on that level, it's taken all that stress out of the equation. However, the stress of performing is always there, especially in the recording, because it's forever. It's like whenever you commit something to tape, that's it. That's what everyone forever is going to know that song as being. So it's a different type of stress, but at least one flavor of stress is taken away by having Eric involved.
Gotcha. Earlier this afternoon, I saw on YouTube a tour of his studio. I just saw the first couple minutes and didn't get to really dive into the whole 25 minutes of it. But one of these days, I'll get a tour of it that way.
Yeah, definitely. You should. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a lot of great groundbreaking records are recorded there. You know?
Absolutely. The other day I saw on Twitter you posted about you guys did a video shoot for Walk With Me in Nightmares. June 10th this was posted, so you guys were working almost up to the wire leaving for the tour, huh?
Yeah, I mean that's it's a job, you know what I mean? You got to have a work ethic, and you know, literally up to the day I left I was working on band stuff, you know, on either, you know, video shoots or press, you know. Logistics, like things like that. It's like a 24/7 operation, you know. And you know, the video, I wanted to get that done before we left, just so that it's off my plate and I don't have to think about it while I'm on the tour. And hopefully we're gonna have a cut, like a rough cut next week. So
gotcha. Well, still it's in many ways out of your hands and off your plate.
That's exactly right, yeah.
Good. Now, speaking of business, did you bring any of your Savage Gold coffee on the road to be sold at the merch table?
I did not actually. I used to do that a couple of years ago, but now it's like, it's just better. I find that it doesn't travel very well. And I'd really, if somebody is going to buy anything from me, I want it to be, you know, intact when I sell it to them. So for now, you can buy it online and you can get it on Amazon and all those sort of outlets.
Okay, fair enough. Understood. Yeah, perishable items.
Yep, absolutely.
All right. Now, I will now direct any listeners of this to your website, everythingwentblackmedia.com, because that's a good all-in-one stop for a lot of your activities. And you're a busy guy, and I respect that. When someone just does music, I'm like, well, there's got to be more to you than that. But there clearly is with you. Now, we mentioned MMA before. Are you able to catch a lot of the MMA stuff while you're still on the road?
Sometimes, but as you know, a lot of times the show happens right around the same time the main event happens. So the main card usually starts at 10, and that's literally right around the time we go on a lot of times. So unfortunately, I have to watch it like either afterwards or just catch the news the next morning. Or, you know, I try to stay up to date on everything that's going on with MMA and combat sports in general. So But yeah, that's the one bummer about being on the road is like you miss a lot of the fights. So
absolutely. Well, I mean, no one was expecting you to catch the one in Singapore. With Holly Holm and Besh Kohea.
That was today.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, I think the main card started at 10 a.m. and I think I woke up at 10 a.m.
Understood. Yeah. All right. Now, who are your favorite guys to watch in MMA? We know your relationship with We Are Outside, if anyone's questioning that. We know your friendship with Josh Barnett, but aside from him, who else is out there that you really respect?
Oh, there's tons of fighters in general. I mean, you know, I've always been a huge George St. Pierre fan. I think he takes the spirit of martial arts into the oftentimes crass MMA world, and I respect that about him. Believe it or not, as on pure fighting ability and, you know, technique, I like John Jones quite a bit. I mean, he's got a lot of his personal problems to work through. Overall, MMA, like Chuck Liddell, like, you know, legend. You know, Matt Serra's a legend. You know, the Diaz brothers, I like their attitude, you know, and they're like, you know, I'm always big fans of them. Demetrius Johnson is probably one of my top five favorite fighters of all time. You know, he's undefeated in his weight class and he's like an incredible technician. And then I also extend this to, you know, kickboxing and Muay Thai, and, you know, probably some of my favorite kickboxers are Joe Schilling, who fights for Bellator kickboxing. Kevin Ross, who's, you know, both of those guys have years and years and years of kickboxing fights. And, I mean, I can go on and on about different fighters, you know, and of course the Gracie family, you know, those guys are legends, that whole family's legends, and they're the reason why jiu-jitsu is, even here in the United States. So, but, yeah, that's a huge passion of mine. I can talk for hours and hours and hours about martial arts.
I'll just throw Damian Maia in there. I'm glad he's getting a title shot.
Yeah, totally. Damian Maia is a beast, man. I mean, it's, you know, finally he gets the title shot. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, and I'm looking forward to that. I think it's going to be a great fight.
Absolutely, yeah. Now, what are your thoughts on all these interim belts that are just being passed around at UFC?
I think it's ridiculous. I mean, if someone's out for like a year on like an injury or something, then yeah, I can see it. But there's, I think that, I mean, I have a lot of ideas about what the UFC is going through, and I think that with their purchase, you know, their new owners want to create excitement, and that's what's more exciting than watching a championship fight. So that's why they create these interim belts, and it's just kind of silly, I think. It kind of gets away from the real essence of combat sports, you know. I think pride was probably the best when it came to a martial arts competition. You know, it's just like, I really like the rule set. I like the 8-minute first round and all that sort of stuff. And I feel like the UFC might be getting away from combat sports and martial arts and making more of like a spectacle out of it. And that's, but you know, they gotta recoup all that money they spent. So
absolutely,
yeah.
I have similar thoughts about the women's featherweight division that was created, and then now no one wants to be in it except for Cyborg and maybe Megan Anderson. And
definitely, yeah. Because Jermaine Durandamy ran away when she figured that she had to fight Chris Cyborg. Yeah. And I mean, I don't see why they couldn't find a bunch of solid 145 pounders. I think Invicta has a featherweight division, so why not promote some of those ladies up to the featherweight division? I'd like to see those fights. You know, I think it'd be great.
Yeah, Megan Anderson is the champion there, I think so.
Yeah,
exactly. So, all right. Now, you've mentioned in another interview that you spend a lot of nights training in Muay Thai and Jiu-Jitsu, and that helps burn off excess energy at the end of the day.
Yeah.
When you're on tour, how do you replace that?
Oh, well, you know, every night you get to play a set, and that's a huge cathartic sort of release. And I try to do some kind of working out. Mm-hmm. I'm not always successful, you know, just so you got to move the body around, you know what I mean? And but, yeah, mainly playing the set is enough to kind of keep the juices flowing and, you know, get rid of that stress and all that sort of stuff.
Yes.
When you're done with touring for whatever release you would be out on tour on, do you get post-tour depression?
Absolutely, man. I mean, that's a great question, by the way. Because, yeah, you develop, it's like, I imagine, like, when you come home from, everything is like going a million miles a minute when you're on the road. Every day you're somewhere else. You got all these guys that you see every day, different bands, you know, like, you know, merch guy, like that we're traveling with, you know, the guys in the band, you see them all the time. And then you come home and it's like a dead stop and like zero potential. And it's just like, boom. And if you've been gone long enough, the seasons might have changed, or like, you know, there might be like you know, that they might have dug up the street in front of your apartment, you know, and everything else around you sort of changed. But when you come home, it's like, it's still, you're kind of jumping onto this like moving car in a way. And then, but that car is kind of only going 5 miles an hour, and you're used to going 100 miles an hour. So it's that sort of like malaise that kicks in after being on the road is like, you know, it takes a couple of days to kind of snap out of that. You know what I mean?
Plus, it seems like, you know, till you get to the end of your tour, you're really hitting your stride. Everybody's, you know, super tight, you know, and then it all comes to a screeching halt. So I can understand how that could be, you know, nearly traumatic, you know.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Luckily for us, we always have a nice full plate. So I'm only home maybe for like another 6 weeks or something like that. And then I go back out on the road and it's, you know, and it's good. And, you know, back in the days when we would only do one or two tours a year, it was like, you know, you kind of catch on to normal life again, and then you got to go through this big upheaval once again. And it's, you know, it's definitely like an emotional roller coaster, and you know, people deal with that stuff in different ways, you know, and it takes about a week to kind of assimilate again, you know.
Well, and your activity helps negate some of my concern. Like, whenever a band tours infrequently and then you catch the first night or two of the tour, it's like, oh, they probably practiced once before they did that. And it's, you know, I usually try to catch them halfway through and then they're still tight. Then they get really tight, but they're not completely sick of being on the road.
Yeah, so, yeah, I agree with that. Totally.
But, all right. Now, horror movies are another big thing for you, as evidenced by your Necromaniacs podcast. Yes, we have a Texas Chainsaw Massacre Leatherface shirt. Thumbs up all around. Your mentioning of the Black Coat's Daughter in the last couple weeks inspired me to rush and see that.
You like that?
Watched it 2 days ago. I watched that.
Excellent.
And that was a good surprise. Oh, yeah. Yeah. You. Have you seen Fear, Inc. yet?
Not yet. I'm looking to catch that one, too.
That it starts off by seeming like it's, you know, kind of like corny or like, if you remember back in the 90s, the movie The Game.
Oh, yeah,
with what was it, Michael Douglas and Sean Penn,
right,
and my favorite hottie, Deborah Kara Unger.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But it's almost like that.
Okay.
It's got that feel, and they even mentioned that movie the movie.
Cool.
So it's got that whole kind of feel to it. So when you get a chance, check that one out, because that one's, you know, it's a good one.
I'm all about it, man. Yeah, I've heard of it. I've done a little bit of reading about it, and it's 100% something I want to watch when I get a chance.
Have you seen it's The Witch, but it's two V's.
Yeah.
Have you seen that?
Yes, actually, we covered that on my horror podcast. Yeah, it was great.
Yeah,
it was excellent.
That was totally threw me off. You know, I enjoyed it, you know, immensely.
Yeah.
You know, but it was so hard at the beginning to like. I mean, the accents are so thick.
Yeah,
he's got like, yeah, and
definitely
so very well done.
Yeah.
You know, all of that was really, really well done.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned The Witch, because I feel like movies like The Witch and The Black Coat's Daughter are like kind of the new direction that horror might be going in. These kind of moody, slow moving, like atmospheric kind of films that are really have an eye towards like making it more of like an artsy film as opposed to just like a slasher, which I love too. I mean, I love all the whole genre, but I like that there's a little bit more of like a sense of art that's going into making the films these days, you know.
Okay, I got one question to ask in the horror movie area here. Out of all of the George Romero Dead series, we're talking all the way from Night of the Living Dead all the way up to
Survival
of the Dead, plus, you know, the remakes of what was the first two. So out of all of those, which is your favorite?
I'm going to have to go old school on that, and I'm going to say Night of the Living Dead for sure. The very first one, there's something in all of those movies I love. However, I feel like when you watch Night of the Living Dead today, you still feel like you're watching something that's groundbreaking.
Yeah.
And it's like still really scary, you know? Yeah, and the black and white atmosphere, like the whole thing. The movie is just so much, it's filled with so much atmosphere. And it really spawned like, you know, like a whole new genre of horror films, yeah. And it still really works on like a very physical level, I think. Yeah. So that's still my favorite.
I think the first one I saw was Dawn of the Dead, back when it had midnight movies. Yep. And then I saw Day of the Dead. Now, I'm a huge Tom Savini fan.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, he's the mastermind. He was the one that started making things that looked really real.
Yeah.
You know, and really, I mean, took on a whole new level of special effects. But since I've watched all of them, and then pretty much have all of them on Blu-ray,
yeah.
I've really gotten to like the last one, Survival of the Dead. Because that introduced another new feeling to it also. You know, it was this, they're trying to find out how to feed these zombies so that they don't eat people.
Yep, yeah.
And I'm not going to give away anything to anybody who's going to be hearing this. So, no spoilers, you know. But the ending of that is just, you know, really good. But I thought that was pretty groundbreaking because, you know, Diary of the Dead, you know, Land of the Dead. Yeah. Some of those, you know, weren't that good. Like the one with John Leguizamo.
Yeah, Land.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought that it was going to be all over at that point. And then Survival came out and just really knocked me for a loop. I thought that was fantastic. And a movie to check out if you haven't checked it out yet, State of Emergency.
I haven't seen that. Okay, State of Emergency. All right, cool.
Very cool movie.
Yeah, I remember that. I'll write that down for sure.
And a shout out to my most underrated Romero flick, Martin. Love it.
Yes, absolutely. Not very many people give props to that movie. Yeah. That's a great movie. Yeah.
All right, now.
Also black and white.
There you go.
Yeah, great.
Now, with your love and knowledge of horror, any thoughts of trying your hand at a screenplay?
You know what, man? I think about it, but I think I would rather stick to like the journalistic eye, you know, and write about it, you know. And I think about, you know, getting involved in writing some kind of like, you know, book about the genre, like picking some sort of like, you know, some sort of point to make and, you know, do some writing about it. But I don't think, my mind doesn't really work like in that sort of narrative sense as far as writing screenplays go. Maybe some fiction, you know, but not an actual screenplay or something like that. I don't know enough about filmmaking to do anything in that realm.
Well, at the very least, I mean, just having the script and meeting the right person, they can take it across the finish line, but who knows?
True.
All right. Now, I actually tweeted at you the other day as the lesser of two equals, and you had mentioned in your talk with Josh Barnett about Iron Maiden frontmen, and he said he hasn't heard anything by Blaze Bailey, so what's your opinion of Blaze Bailey's?
I have like next to no opinion because I only maybe spent about 30 seconds listening to Blaze Bailey in my entire life. Yeah. I mean, I'm aware that he was the singer in Iron Maiden, but like, and I gotta be honest, man, you probably listened to the episode. I'm like not the biggest Bruce Dickinson fan either, really. I mean, I think I like Bruce Dickinson. I think he's a excellent, you know, like character in heavy metal, showman, but I just can't get, to me, it's always Paul Di'Anno in Iron Maiden, you know? I love Paul Di'Anno, man. And not only his vocals, but just the whole, like, vibe of the band at that era, to me, was my favorite. Because it's like, it's like real high energy. It almost had, it's like, the same way, like, Thin Lizzy had, like, a real street vibe. I think, like, Iron Maiden had a similar street vibe to, like, Thin Lizzy, you know? And, I mean, that's like, that era of rock music is my... I hold that dear in my heart because that's when I was a young kid. That was the kind of music I listened to that got me into like other things.
Absolutely.
You know, like Thin Lizzy, Deep Purple, UFO. I noticed your tattoo there. You know, all those bands. Iron Maiden, and Iron Maiden being more of like a heavy metal band was the gateway to other bands like Metallica and Slayer and all that other stuff. So you know, they're a little bit more intense than some of the other bands. You know. You know, and Judas Priest, all that stuff. It's like, that's my early, like, sort of realization that I like music that was a little bit more aggressive than some of the other kids I knew, you know?
Do you gravitate more to the first album or Killers?
That's a great question, man, but I'm going to say my answer is Killers.
Same here.
Yeah.
Hey.
Murders in the Rue Morgue, man. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah.
I'll third that one.
Yeah. Excellent.
But that first record, it's got some great jams on it.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah.
Like, Running Free, mm-hmm. you know? Also, it's like...
Remember Tomorrow.
Yeah, Remember Tomorrow, great song, right? And another band I hold dear to my heart is Bon Scott, AC/DC.
Okay.
You know, it's like, that stuff is like, you know, just the most, like, essential, like, hard rocking band is AC/DC, and especially the Bon Scott era. Mm-hmm. And I don't really get too into the Brian Jones vibe. I think, like, I like, you know, Back in Black,
yeah.
And, you know, For Those About to Rock is a great record, but, like,
it's hit and miss after that.
Yeah, after that, it's, like, real sketchy, you know?
Well, as we said, you're starting out the tour, and you've got a couple more weeks on this one. Anything else in 2017 that you can...
Yeah, we do. I can't quite announce it just yet, but it's, like, pretty cool stuff going on in the fall. Mm-hmm. You know, I wish I could talk about it, but it's not... You know,
we'll keep an eye on social
how
media.
Labels are where it's they want to, like, be the ones to announce shit, and you know, if you say something before they're ready to have the information out, they kind of, like, get mad at you, and, you know, so I'm really excited about it, and I wish I could talk about it, but I can't.
Fine.
So,
but the fall, that's all we need to know. That's cool. Yeah. All right, I end every interview with this one, and it's usually an annoying one, but one album the rest of your life on a desert island.
That's a great question, man. Let's see here. One album.
I wouldn't be able to answer.
I couldn't.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, I can answer it, but I know that the minute I walk away from here, I'm like, oh man, it's like this other record, man. Mm-hmm. So, I'm gonna have to say a record that I have on the desert island for the rest of my life would have to be "Masters of Reality" by Black Sabbath.
Okay.
Yeah, that's got, like, that's kind of. I mean, I know once again, man, I'm gonna change my mind about it, something else once we walk away from here, but it's like. You know, that one pretty much, like, you know, defined what people think, like, Black Sabbath set to sound like, I think, in some ways. So that, yeah. And some of my favorite songs are on that record. You know, Into the Void, you know, it's great.
That's great, yeah. It's not even so much about the answer. It's how you arrive at that. Some people have the approach, like, oh, the Beatles' White Album because of variety. For me, it's like the Clash, London Calling because of the variety and everything.
Yeah, that you know, that record is just, look, even the album cover is just, like, something about just, like, that stark black cover with a weird purple. It's like you look at that record and you know exactly what it's going to sound like. You know it's going to be this, like, really heavy, like, low end, and, you know, really intense lyrics. And that's kind of like, I feel like on that record the lyrical content was, like, a little bit more developed than some of the other albums. Sure. Like the first, you know, there was their fourth album, right?
I think that was their fourth, yeah.
Yeah, the album's prior.
Masters of Reality?
Third,
okay.
Okay, so the two prior records.
The next one was Volume 4,
right? Yeah, there you go. Yeah, self-explanatory. But, yeah, it's as far as, like, their first album, Paranoid, great classic records, but I think that once Masters came around, that was, like, really where they dug into, like, this, like, dark, like, vibe they had, you know?
Well, we could keep you here another 2 hours, but, you know, you've got your things to do, and you have to refuel and all that. So I want to thank you for taking the time to enlighten us. And, just keep creating content.
Will do, man.
Absolutely.